On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. 40 years ago today, June 5th, 1967, Israel and its Arab neighbors exploded into war.
The tension in the Middle East over the Gulf of Aqaba blockade develops into full-scale war, with reports of heavy fighting between Israeli and Egyptian forces along the Gaza Strip and the Sinai border.
Arab threats had been loud and bloody. Israel finally acted preemptively, famously taking out the Egyptian Air Force in a morning, taking over the Golan Heights, Gaza, East Jerusalem, and the West Bank. Arabs were crushingly humiliated. Israel had a dizzying triumph. But 40 years on, its taste is not so sweet. This hour on Point, Israeli historian and journalist Tom Segev on the Six-Day War and its consequences for Israelis, for Palestinians, and for the world. Joining me now from Washington is Tom Segev, Israeli historian, journalist, and columnist for the daily newspaper Haaretz. His book, an Israeli bestseller in Hebrew, now out in English, is 1967, Israel, the War, and the Year That Transformed the Middle East. Tom Segev, welcome. Thanks very much for joining us today.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
You've got a big and subtle book about the culture and the moment in history and its reverberations through the decades since then. But be a simple friend to us and outline for those who were not alive there and do not know this history the basics before we get into the complexities, the basics of what happened in that May and June of 1967.
It all started in 1965 when Palestinian terrorists started to penetrate Israel from Syria. This caused tension between Israel and Syria. That tension then spread to the Egyptian border. Egypt moved forces into the Sinai and threatened to close the southern port of Israel, Eilat, and that made many Israelis believe that Egypt is actually going to destroy it. And we decided to strike preemptively, as you said. The war resulted in a spectacular victory for Israel, destroying the entire Egyptian Air Force and taking vast lands from Egypt, from Jordan, and from Syria.
Let's take our minds back for a minute to how many of us here in the U.S. saw events unfold, if I may, Tom. Here's a Universal newsreel reporting about 4 days into the Six-Day War, the kind of thing you might have seen at a drive-in movie waiting for Bonnie and Clyde to begin.
War in the Middle East. Israeli forces drive spearheads across the Sinai Peninsula, west to the Suez Canal, south to the entrance of the Gulf of Aqaba, breaking the blockade, capturing the west bank of the Jordan River, and occupying the old city of Jerusalem. The first crippling blow came early in the four-day war, when the Arab Air Force was destroyed on the ground in air raids on 25 bases in three countries, Egypt, Jordan, and Syria.
It sounds old, maybe 40 years old, and it is now. Tom, what were your personal memories of that war? You're early 60s now, so you were well old enough to remember. Where were you?
Yeah, I was 23 during the war, and I was not called to into service. I volunteered for in a kibbutz, in kibbutz Gvulot. Instead, and as soon as we heard that Jerusalem was taken, we left our posts at the kibbutz and rushed back to Jerusalem. And I remember very well the elation and the euphoria of walking into the old city, which for all my life had been forbidden land, the other side of the moon, if you want. Mm-hmm. I grew up in Jerusalem, and Jerusalem was divided with minefields and barbed wire. And all of a sudden, you could go there and see that there were actually people living there, and there were cars and shops, and it was quite an amazing experience.
Of course, before this war, the West Bank, part of Jordan, Egyptians in Gaza Strip. After, Israel with all of that, plus the Golan Heights and the old city of Jerusalem. and Israeli soldiers there in occupation that goes on to this day. You are famously a...
Not in Sinai,
yes, absolutely. But Tom, you're famously a revisionist historian. So what are you revising in this great big history that you're offering us here? Maybe the thing to do is, you know, give us the kind of, as you see it anyway, the grand myth of 1967, and then a taste of the reality that you want to bring us beyond and behind that.
Well, first of all, this is not a book about the war. This is really a book about Israelis before the war and after the war.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, this is a Cold War story. This is an Arab-Israeli story. This is an Palestinian story. But more than anything else, it is an Israeli story. You cannot really understand 1967 unless you understand why and how Israelis reacted. It's a lot about Israeli society. It's a lot about Israeli psychology. Israelis genuinely believed that Egypt is going to destroy them. And the question is, why did they believe that? They believed that because this crisis of May 67 struck at the worst point in Israel's history from a psychological point of view. The society was very, very weak. There was economic recession, unemployment. More Israelis were leaving the country than Jews coming to live there. There's only one other year that happened, and people didn't believe in the political leadership, and there were various other factors which led to the fact that they were very, very weak. And when this crisis began, they foresaw another Holocaust, quite authentic. One of the things I did for this book was to collect, to go to Israelis who have been living in this country for many years, and I said to them, go up the attic and down the basement and get me some letters from friends and relatives you received in Israel in 1967. And I was able to collect some 500 such letters. So there's no question that the Holocaust played a tremendous role in the fear and the panic that preceded the war, and that undoubtedly led to the decision to strike at Egypt. But that was only one of the three wars of that week. The story of the war with Jordan is very different. By the time the war with Jordan started, we had already defeated the Egyptian Air Force. So the existential threat could not have played such a strong role. Now, on June the 5th, 1967, Jordan attacked the Israeli part of Jerusalem.
Right.
And as a result, Israel took East Jerusalem and the West Bank. This was militarily not necessary. We could have just hit back at the Jordanian army without occupying all these territories. And the interesting thing about it is that occupying these territories contradicted the national interest of Israel. And the people at the time knew it. 6 months prior to the war, the heads of the Mossad, the army intelligence, and the heads of the Foreign Office got together and did something Israelis don't very often do. They tried to think ahead to the future, plan the future. And they asked themselves, under what circumstances may it be necessary to take the West Bank?
Mm-hmm.
And they concluded that it is not in the interest of Israel to take the West Bank. Why?
Because
of the Palestinian population, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Because this would encourage Palestinian nationalism. This would be very harmful to the nature of Israel as a Jewish and democratic society. And eventually it would lead to armed resistance. Everything that actually happened.
Mm.
They knew it then. Comes the day, June 5th, all reason is forgotten. And what you have here is a cabinet that really doesn't make decisions with their heads. They actually act from the hearts.
You describe them.
It's all emotional. It's all irrational.
Mm.
It's all about history. It's all about religion.
Mm-hmm.
It's all about 2,000 years of longing for Zion. And so they actually took a decision that contradicted the national interest of Israel, and they knew it, and it still does contradict the national interest of Israel even today, to have these territories.
Swinging there from that pre-war near despair you described, a time of low morale in Israel to that incredible mm-hmm. destruction of the Egyptian Air Force, and then everything seemed possible, havable, including even the West Bank that, as you say, the Israeli intelligence had warned,
that's right.
you don't want to take that, but it was taken.
That's right. The euphoria was already playing a role. And yes, the feeling that we can do it. So what, in hindsight, they should have said was, yes, we can, but we shouldn't because it's not good for us. But that's not the way they thought.
Is that too much to ask all these decades later? Here, an existential talk about existential threat. It was there for Israel. The Holocaust was recent in Israelis' memory. Is it too much to ask that Israel would have exercised that reason at that moment?
Not where Egypt is concerned. That's why I say that. I think that the war with Egypt was inevitable, even though we don't really know what the Egyptians intended to do. Mm-hmm. We don't know because we don't have Egyptian sources. We don't have Egyptian documents. So we don't really know, but it doesn't matter. What matters is what Israelis thought the Egyptians will be do to them, and that was enough.
We're talking about the Six-Day War, 40 years on this hour, and its consequences for Israelis and Palestinians and for the world, for the rest of us. Tom Segev is with us, historian and journalist. His new book is recently translated into English, newly translated, 1967, Israel, the War and the Year That Transformed the Middle East, a number one bestseller in Israel, one of a string of a lot of great books from Tom Segev, but this one coming out at a time, well, of great difficulty, as we've had for 40 years now in this relationship, and some looking back with fresh eyes on what happened in 1967. We've got some sound here from that time. Here's BBC reporter Michael Elkins reporting from downtown Jerusalem during the 1967 Six-Day War.
You can hear the machine gun fire. This is a full-scale battle. There are bullets hitting past down below the junction of Jaffa Road. There are bullets hitting past, and people have fallen down, lying in the street. They are apparently not hit, but they are lying down. There goes the clump of a heavy shell.
Israelis had felt the very existence of their country in question when it was over. The victory was enormous. It set off a tremendous euphoria. Tom, you write the fear was so great that at one point Shimon Peres considered trying to prevent the Six-Day War, pulling out nuclear weapons.
Not exactly. Shimon Peres, who is the last of the decision makers who is still alive and in government, suggested that Israel conduct a nuclear test, not, God forbid, use a nuclear bomb. I don't even know that Israel had a nuclear bomb at that time, but there was obviously something to test.
But to use the nuclear capacity to intimidate potential
threats. There was obviously something to test, and he thought that it would cause a big boom and scare the Arabs and restore Israeli confidence in themselves and thereby prevent the need to go to war. He was against the war, interestingly enough. He was member of a party, a small opposition party headed by David Ben-Gurion, and David Ben-Gurion was against the war. Mm-hmm. And that is so interesting because we sometimes feel that everything happened the way it should have happened, and it did not. There were alternatives, and that was definitely a very dramatic alternative. Peres made that suggestion very late in time, I think 2 days before the war. Nothing came out of it. It is for us to discover as one of the exciting and quite amazing details about that war.
But, of course, here's a diversion from the sort of storybook version of 1967, or the commonly accepted one, at least the one that's come down to somebody like me at a great distance. The idea, I always thought that there was no option here, that the country's existence was on the line, they had to act or risk being destroyed. Are you saying that even 2 days before, 1 day before, there were honest other options like what?
Shimon Peres is definitely a man to listen to. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is not a post-Zionist left wing. He's actually the father of a lot of Israeli security projects, and so I think it's quite interesting that he thought that what is needed is a psychological answer to what he regarded, and I think correctly, basically as a psychological problem. So, again, we don't really know what the Egyptians intended to do. Their moves, and perhaps more importantly, their language was extremely threatening. And it's quite understandable why, such a short time after the Holocaust, Israelis would believe them. After the war, there was a really interesting conversation between King Hussein and an Israeli diplomat called Yaakov Herzog. Mm. And Herzog says to Hussein, you know, the problem is that the Arabs don't understand Israel. And King Hussein says to him, no, the problem is that you don't understand the Arabs. For example, when we threaten you, you believe us. Mm. Why do you believe us? We never meant it. Mm. But of course, this is not an option not to believe. And so this is why I think we really should distinguish between the situation along the Egyptian border and the situation along the Jordanian border. There was no basis to believe that Jordan threatens the existence of Israel. But there was reason to believe that the Egyptians do. And so this is why the war with Egypt was inevitable and the war with Jordan was not.
Mm. Tom Segev, I have so many more questions for you here, but they come from our listeners as well, and I want to turn to them, if
All
I
right.
may. Calling from New Britain, Connecticut, Aram is on the line. Aram, you're on the air.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call, Tom.
Certainly, yeah.
Tom and Tom.
Yes.
I'm Israeli, and I was actually 12 years old, living in Rishon LeZion when the Six-Day War came about, and living in the United States now for some time, I compare the Six-Day War event to slavery because ever since, I think this Six-Day War, it has been the divisive line that where all politics and everything in Israeli society has been determined by that. So, you know...
Are you saying it divided the country? It divided Israelis somehow, Aram?
Yes, divided between left and right. That defined, you know, what is right and what is left. It defined everything. I think we grew up ever since. You know, it prevented us from dealing with issues of polarity in Israeli society between, say, Mizrahi and Ashkenazi, religious, economic equality. It didn't. You know, we in education, in growing up in Israel, in the schools, I don't think I ever learned about Arabs as humans, as human beings with faith, with culture, with and.
But why should a victory drive division, Aram?
Yes, I think that it drove division, and it also brought about all the leaders ever since were unlike Ben Gurion. We're not civilians anymore; became the generals. You know, our generals became our kings, ever since, Arik Sharon and so on. We really, if I remember all the albums, of course, of the success, the victory, and with huge picture of Chaim Rabin and Chaim, you know, all of these different generals who then became our leaders.
Yeah, yeah. Aram, let us pick it up with Tom Segev. Tom, do you see the same division that Aram describes resulting from the Six-Day War within the Israeli body politic?
First of all, it's an interesting coincidence that Aram comes from Rishon LeZion, because the major hero of my book, who wrote a really interesting diary, actually comes from Rishon LeZion. And Rishon LeZion is, to me, like the real Israel, like Wahoo, Nebraska is the real America. Mm. And so I think what he feels is something many Israelis do feel. The Israeli society is deeply divided over the future of the territories. And interestingly enough, for the last 40 years, I think since December of 1967, no new idea has come up. Every possible solution was discussed between June and December of 1967. And we have been unable to agree on what to do with the territories, and that is definitely the major rift in the Israeli society. No other subject has caused so much controversy as the future of the territories, and we have been unable to agree on anything. And I think that this is one of the perhaps the major tragedy of Israel, that we have been unable to agree on what to do with the territories. So we decided to do nothing, which, looking back,
nothing as in keep the status quo, the occupation, the soldiers,
yes,
there, the roadblocks,
yes,
and the rest.
Because we weren't, and at the same time doing nothing, but while supposedly doing nothing, we moved 400,000 people into East Jerusalem and the West Bank. And with every settler, it becomes more difficult to solve the conflict. And so what we would have needed in 1967 was very, very strong leadership with vision. And we didn't have that. We had a very weak prime minister at that time. And, of course, everybody was euphoric, and everybody for some time at least believed that Israel's power is unlimited. This is a time when people told each other a joke about two generals talking to each other. The one asks the other, what should we do today? The other says, you know what, let's take Cairo. And the first one says, well, that's a good idea, but what should we do in the afternoon?
It would be that simple, that powerful.
This is the feeling of unlimited power, which very quickly turned out to be an illusion.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that. You've been quoted recently saying all these dreams of 1967 were actually illusions. What were the dreams that you see born in that victory? And beyond that, unopposable power, what other illusions emerged?
At the beginning, everything seemed to be working well. The Palestinians did not resist. They actually came to work in Israel. Many thousands of Israelis went to visit the West Bank and went to the markets and bought whatever the Palestinian markets had to offer, from Chinese-made pencils to goods from Singapore or whatever, which we didn't have in Israel. And so we felt very good about it. The world did not force us to leave these territories. And so we felt that we have all the time in the world to wait until the Arabs are ready for peace. And so we developed the illusion of a temporary situation. I think that 40 years later, we need to admit that we are not in a temporary situation anymore. The geopolitical situation in Palestine has changed, and it has become much, much more difficult today to reach any agreement with the Palestinians. But I think that Aram is also right in saying, I think that what he wants to say is that 1967 is still going on today. The same conflict, the same debates. It's the longest year.
That's a long, long time. Let me take a call from Newton, Massachusetts, and Miriam. Miriam, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. I would like you, Mr. Segev, to comment on the change that has taken place, if it has taken place, or what you perceive as the morale in the Israeli army at that time and the morale today. And let me just quickly explain why. I have many friends in Jewish Voices for Peace, United for Peace and Justice, who are Jews, and who hate Israel with a venom that really slays me, even as critical as I am of Israeli policies. And I remember, since I was in Israel right after the Six-Day War and before then, I know Israel fairly well, particularly if I can just take a moment to characterize what the difference was. I remember going to the Sisters of Zion Convent and the Herodian Fortress, and one of the nuns told me...
That's in Jerusalem.
In Jerusalem, in East Jerusalem. You couldn't have gone there before the Six-Day War.
Right.
For me, as a Jew, it was exciting because I was seeing the history of Christianity laid out right before me in that fortress. In any case, one of the nuns said that they had been so anti-Israeli before the war, but that during the war, they had to turn it into a hospital, and they were shocked that as they saw, they knew, they heard the Israeli radio, but they heard the Jordanian radio, that Jordanians were still out there fighting because they were being told by the Jordanian government that the Arabs were winning, that Israel would soon collapse. And at the same time, they saw Israeli soldiers guarding holy places, they said, with their bodies. Christian holy places with their bodies.
Also Muslim ones.
Mm-hmm. And Muslim. And there's just one other thing, which to me has been one of the most extraordinary examples of soldiers in war. And that is, in Jerusalem, there's a hill called Givat HaTachmoshet. And on that hill... That's right. And on that hill, there is a memorial, stones piled up, just as in the Bible, by Israeli soldiers who, in commemoration of the courage and the bravery of the soldiers, or Jordanian soldiers, they had to fight there in hand-to-hand combat. I was stunned when I saw that.
But the morale change you're talking about, Miriam, what is it? Is it good, bad, indifferent?
The morale change has, to me, seems to be, so it seems like a totally different army when you read of what's happening in the occupied territories. I don't know. I would like Mr. Segev to comment
on that. So a change not for the better, you're suggesting. Tom Segev?
Well, obviously it makes a difference if an army occupies the territories for the first time. And I think that most soldiers who actually entered the East Jerusalem and the West Bank did so without hate. And that is perhaps a major difference. Now, 40 years later, there is a second and third generation of soldiers who really don't do anything else than patrol the occupied territories and control the population, and have become a very oppressive army, actually. And you could see that during the last war in Lebanon, when all of a sudden it turned out that they are not doing such a good job fighting anymore, because they have been trained to work mainly as an occupation gendarmerie. And so I think that following 40 years of occupation, the oppression and also terrorism, the fear of terrorism, has become part of these young people's identity as Israelis. So they are very, very different people. The soldiers who entered the Old City and the West Bank probably believed in peace. Soldiers today in Israel probably don't anymore, as young people in Israel don't believe in peace anymore. And I think that is definitely one of the unfortunate outcomes of 40 years of life without peace with the Palestinians.
We're going to hear in just a moment from a Palestinian who lived through that same war. But let me take a couple of calls first. One from Traverse City, Michigan. Matt, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Tom. Thank you very much.
Certainly.
Very quickly, I wanted to ask your guest if, in his opinion, the sinking of the USS Liberty was a deliberate act by the Israelis or a tragic accident.
Tom Sikov, remind us of what happened there. An American ship went down under Israeli fire, many dead. 34 crew members dead, 171 injured, the Liberty. Tell us that story, Tom.
That's the story, Tom. I think
Where was it?
The ship was near Eilat, and it was attacked by Israel. And I have concluded, after long thought and studying practically everything there is, I've concluded that it was an accident. And the major reason why I have concluded that is because I know the Israelis who gave orders in those days, and none of them, not Prime Minister Eshkol, not Defense Minister Dayan, not the head of the Mossad Amit, not the Chief of Staff Rabin, these are not people who would give an order to attack an American ship. And so since there is absolutely no motive for such an order, I think that we have to conclude that it was an accident.
What day of the war was this, Tom? Which day? of the 6 day
war? I think on the third day. I'm not sure. On the second or the third.
Right. And you know, of course, you report President Johnson in the United States himself called it a deliberate attack, and all these theories are out there, something to do with Israel's nuclear capabilities or intentions to attack Syria, you say, or perhaps a massacre of Egyptian prisoners or something else. All these have been floated, but just they don't hold water in your research.
They don't. This is such an outrageous incident that obviously people have a hard time to take the simple answer that it was an accident. And if you go on the internet, you will find any number of conspiracy theories. To the present day, it's a very popular conspiracy.
Can you accidentally sink a warship? I mean, it takes some effort to sink a warship.
It wasn't actually sunk, it was attacked. And it is possible that it happened as a result of an accident. This is the only explanation, because it is not possible that it happened as a result of a deliberate order. And accidents happen in war. I would have no problem exposing a deliberate order to do that if I thought that's the case. But I have really concluded that it is not. And so it's very tragic, of course. And there are still lots of unanswered questions surrounding this. Yes, there are various things which are difficult to answer. And as with dramatic incidents, it always happens when there are unanswered questions, it immediately leads to conspiracy theories. And so I think that this is one of those conspiracy theories which we will not be able to get rid of. It will always be with us. There will always be people who won't believe that it was an accident, because it's a very simple and cruel answer. It's very banal, and people always feel that there must be more to it than just a stupid mistake.
But we've just got
that's
the fact,
I think, what it was.
An American spy ship hit by Israeli forces, 34 dead and 170-plus wounded, Tom Segev says. Accident. Steve's calling from Lexington, Massachusetts. Steve, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I was a soldier, American soldier then, and I just hung up my uniform recently. I was on alert in Panama for being deployed to the Suez Canal region. And you know, I remember those days very distinctly. And by the way, you know, the reports of the sailors on the Liberty, was the American flag was flying high, and they were attacked not once but twice, right at low altitude. And I don't know how, I'm a pilot, I don't know how they missed the American flag flying on a ship like that. But so that's a question Israelis have to answer. So, but anyway, my question is a broader question, and that is, I went to the Vietnam Memorial, and I walked away from that in tears, thinking, you know, what did this solve? You know, 60,000 American dead, hundreds of thousands of Vietnamese dead. Did it really solve anything? And then I think back to the Six-Day War. I think back to what's going on in Iraq now and other wars, because you know, I've served for a long time, and you know, it really didn't solve anything except to polarize sides and make people hate each other.
But what about saving Israel? Many people point to that.
The occupation forces, you know, I want to make a parallel between what happened in the Six-Day War and what's happening in Iraq today. United States Army is not trained as highly trained as an occupation force. We're trained to have battle and to win. But what occupation does do is it creates suspicion, hatred. It doesn't solve any problems. And I'll tell you, you know, the two most powerful things that happened in the century, in the 20th century for peace, was first the Peace Corps under JFK and Shriver, and because that created understanding and help for people that really needed help without going to conflict.
So, Steve, you're saying, as a vet, let's not go down the war path, and we hear that, and we're hearing the consequences described by Tom Segev in this hour. I want to get another voice in while we have time. Joining us from Normal, Illinois, is Issam Nasser, professor of history at Illinois State University, author of European Portrayals of Jerusalem. He was a young boy during the 1967 war and saw that war from the other side of the conflict. Issam Nasser, Professor Nasser, thanks very much for being with us.
Oh, thank you for inviting me to participate.
Remind us of your memory of the onset of this war.
Well, I lived in Ramallah at the time. My parents had left Jerusalem in 1948, lost their home when the State of Israel was created. I was 6 years old in 1967, and of course I've heard of the Israelis and memories of our home and previous mm-hmm. lives that I did not know, of course. Mm-hmm. But I've never seen an Israeli in my life. And then all of a sudden, you know, we have all this noise and excitement almost, you know, from a perspective of a child. It was excitement, planes flying and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And so you could say that my first encounter with the Israelis was the noise of the machine guns and, planes bombing, basically. But then on the day when the Israelis entered Ramallah, and I cannot recall the exact date, mm-hmm. it must have been maybe 2 or 3 days into the war, I saw the Israelis for the first time. They were, small heads speaking from small tanks mm-hmm. that were rolling onto our streets, and they were announcing in some sort of broken Arabic that we should fly white flags on the roofs of our homes. And if there's a house without a white flag, it would be demolished. That's what we were told. And then the one thing that stuck with me, I don't want to bore you with small details, mm. but is that they took actually my bed sheet and put it on a broomstick.
Your family did, in order to yeah. keep the house from being demolished.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And of course, I kept worrying that what if I pee that night, with the bombing and all
with
that
with the
stuff.
Jets flying over a six-year-old might well.
Exactly. So, it was one of those things where I was more worried about if the sheet was dirty than if it's dirty, will it save our house?
If it's not wide enough. Professor Nasser, let me ask you now, when you hear a journalist and historian like Tom Segev, an Israeli reconsidering the meaning of that war and the consequences of that war, as a Palestinian, how do you hear that Israeli self-reflection?
Well, I certainly welcome that self-reflection, although I know Professor Segev is a revisionist historian and he's one of the leading historian in that field, so mm-hmm. he does not exactly represent the official perspective of official Israel, so to speak. Mm-hmm. But I do hope that more Israelis and that his work will influence more Israelis, because to me as a Palestinian, that day never ended. I mean, since the war started and the Israeli tanks rolled into our town, we are still living that nightmare on a variety of ways. And as you know, the war practically mm. is never over. This is, ironically, we call it the Six-Day War rather than the 40-year war or whatever we should call it, maybe 100 years. Mm.
Permit me to take a call here, if I may, from New Milford, Connecticut. Justine is calling. Justine, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I appreciate Tom Segev's looking at the conflict and saying that there's a lot of psychology to it. I happen to be a psychologist, and that there is really a psychological problem. And from a psychologist's point of view, I also happen to be someone who's spent a lot of time in Israel and Palestine. Mm. From my point of view, it seems that the Six-Day War and all that's happened continues to be symptoms of an original difficulty, and that's what Israel particularly has not brought itself to look at.
How do you define that difficulty?
The difficulty being, the 1948 war, meaning the ethnic cleansing of a whole people, and the fact that refugees can't return to their homes, that it seems that there can be no peace until one looks at those actions, and that Israelis feel acutely that they're not welcomed in the Middle East, which I empathize with them, but there needs to be a self-reflection, it seems, on why they're not at home in a place that is experiences it as an imposition, and that whatever resolution occurs, it seems that there must be a public and national examination of what you might consider an original sin.
Justine, let us pick it up. Yeah. Our time is so short, and I think we'll hear it. Tom Segev, you do look at the kind of psychological backdrop here. The Holocaust, though, in my reading of your work, is as big as 1948, maybe bigger. But how do you respond to Justine?
Well, I can assure you that most Israelis feel very much at home in Israel and have no psychological difficulty of being Israelis. The problem of the Palestinian refugees obviously needs some solution, and it doesn't have a solution at this time, just as the problem of the Israeli settlers doesn't have a solution at this time. The problem of Jerusalem doesn't have a solution at this time, and so I think that it is about conflict management rather than looking for grand solutions to the problem. I would just like to say to Professor Nasser that if you go on the Haaretz website of today, you will read an article written by Professor Shlomo Avineri, who there is hardly anyone who is more establishment than Professor Avineri, a former Director General of the Foreign Office, and he calls the war the 40 years war, meaning that it is not over. So the views I express are shared by many, many Israelis. Of course, Israel is a very deeply divided society, but it's not as if there aren't enough Israelis who know that something has to be changed, and that the situation created in 1967 really was not a good one. In fact, we gained absolutely nothing from taking the Palestinian territories, and I think that more and more Israelis realize that today.
Let me take one more call. Roberta from Boston. You're on the air, Roberta.
Hi, Tom. Hi. Thanks for taking my call. My comment goes back to the earlier portion of the program. I've been listening to a great deal in between, but I was really wanting to comment on the sense of Israel at the time and how different it is today.
Were you there in 67, Roberta?
I was there in 67, shortly after the war. I was very young. I was, I think, 10 or 11 years old.
And what's the change you've seen?
Well, what was remarkable then is that it was almost a non-militant victory. It felt as if people were not scared about war. They were. You would pick up soldiers in the street carrying rifles, and it was this remarkable sense of we have no intention to kill of killing anyone. We want to make this sort of, maybe this was an illusion, but it was this kind of, you know, we have proven that we are no longer the Jews who were marched into Auschwitz, but we did it as quickly as we could. We bombed airplanes. We try not to kill.
And now, what do you see?
And now what you see is this mire and this oppression and terrible sadness, and a country that really does feel very much like a country that is absorbed by the military, between the military on the Israeli side, the terrorism, the constant feeling that anywhere you go you could be killed. If you're in Israel, the guilt, the sense that we no longer want to be there. My whole background is very left-wing and very, Shomer HaTzair. So the whole sense of not wanting to be in that position is totally oppressive and tremendous amount of hopelessness.
Roberta, thanks for your call. Our time is so short. Issam Nasser, I don't know, a word to Tom Segev from you. You know, what's to be said? Here we are 40 years later, for better or for worse. Here's the reality. What's the word you share today?
Well, I think... Yeah, okay, go ahead.
Issam, first, for a moment, please.
Okay. No, I was going to say, I think that, unfortunately, we are all in it together, so to speak. The Israelis and the Palestinians now, as people, are entangled in this... cycle of hatred almost that is unprecedented. I mean, I know that in 1948 lots of atrocities took place, and I know to the Palestinians it was devastating, but still by 1967 to many Palestinians it was a remote thing. It related to the refugees, not us, so to speak. Everyone thought it's about someone else.
But it's back, and we live with it. Tom Segev, your final thought, do you ever get over this?
My final thought is that there are a lot of things that can be done to make life more livable for both Israelis and Palestinians. It is not about looking for the final peace agreement right now. It's about managing the conflict and making life more livable. There are lots of things that can be done.
Please make it better. Tom Segev's book is 1967. Issam Nasser is professor at Illinois State University. Thanks to you both. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.